This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The 4th of July holiday weekend is fast approaching, and AAA is projecting a record number of Americans will be hitting the road in cars. But more than 3 million travelers are expected to be flying. And with all the news lately about long lines at security checkpoints and the perennial problems of lost luggage, weather delays, and canceled flights, some of you may not be looking forward to the prospect of travel as much as you should be. Vermont's largest airport, Burlington International, is also gearing up for the busy holiday weekend. But beyond the holiday rush, the airport has to work hard to maintain its operations all year round, through snowy winters and ups and downs in the airline industry. And did you know one of the strategies for success at a small airport like ours is getting planes to stay overnight at BTV's gates? Today, we're going to look behind the scenes at the airport to have a better understanding of how it all works and what the pressures are on our regional airport. Gene Richards is Director of Aviation at Burlington International Airport. Ultimately, he's in charge, so he's here today to tell us about how the airport works. Gene, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So, do weekends like this excite you because the dollar signs in your eyes are starting to bling, or do they terrify you because there's just so much potential for more people who are more unhappy, unexpected weather problems, flights that don't go out, and just passengers hating you?
You know, I don't find a lot of that. I find weekends like this to be so exciting. We just to see the hustle bustle and to see everybody doing what they're trained to do is quite exciting.
Is this a big weekend for the airport?
Every weekend is a big weekend. You know, it's every day of the year, 24 hours a day. You know, we do what we do. And regardless of the volumes, we continue to do what we do. And it goes quite well. But yes, it is.
So you do see a surge on these holiday weekends, even though Vermont, I mean, is where everybody should be for a 4th of July weekend.
Yeah, we average around 10,000 a week, and we're up around 12,000.
So let's talk a little bit about these TSA wait times, because this was the horror story of the early summer for travelers. I mean, particularly people traveling through Chicago's O'Hare Airport. There were stories of waiting hours, missing flights just to get through security checkpoints. That seems to have eased up a little bit. But how does the airport work with this federal agency to try to get all of the security screening done?
It's one of the partnerships that we have, and you have to, like every other partnership at the airport, work with them. And we also have a responsibility to work with the airlines to spread the flights out, and we've done that. So when they come to us and they say, you know, things are bunching up, we try to spread things out so that they're not all bunching at one time. Even 15 minutes makes a really big difference. So it's working with TSA, it's communicating with them, and having a good understanding of the common direction that we have. And I guess that's probably why we don't have those issues in Burlington.
When you say you mean like spreading flights out, do you do that on a day-to-day basis, or you mean sort of in your general schedule, you try to plan that out so that your schedule long before the lines start is already spaced?
It's usually 3 to 4 months in advance. And whenever we bring a new flight in, we make sure we place it so it does not put a lot of stress on the system.
So even that 15-minute difference you're scheduling, you're trying to schedule 3 or 4 months out?
Absolutely. Many times 6 and more. It's something that in the airline industry, the more time, the better. And the planners that work with the airlines right down to the minute.
So is that a negotiation then that the airport is involved in that also involves TSA and I would imagine the airlines, because they're trying to work a schedule around all of their various airports?
It's really actually not necessarily a negotiation, much as it is about communication, you know, letting everybody know how the airport works and then listening to what TSA has and what their stresses are. It's a listening game on both ways.
And are you the intermediary there?
Yes, absolutely. You have to be able to send the message both ways. And again, with the weather and things like that, it throws it off occasionally. But generally, because we have so many amenities and things, people stay on the other side of TSA.
We're talking about the airport today. We'd love to know what you want to know about how things are actually working behind the scenes. We're speaking with the top executive at Burlington International, Gene Richards. And if you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your notes on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Of course, if you just need to vent about a recent travel disaster or share some praise and kudos, you can think of our Facebook page as a place to get commiseration and solace. But again, our number, 1-800-639-2211. As part of that question about long wait times at security lines, there was then a rush on people who were trying to get cleared for TSA PreCheck. Does Burlington International even have TSA PreCheck? Can you do that?
We do have it. It isn't used because we do have stresses on our staffing. It's very difficult to staff at times, so it doesn't always work as well as it would work at a larger airport. But when we're able and staffed up to it, we absolutely use it. And we do encourage everybody to get out there and sign up for it.
Why?
Because when you are traveling, it will cut back. It could cut back an hour or longer. It isn't necessarily your experience that you're having at Burlington, but it's the other airports. It really pays.
Yeah, because if you're not even able to use it at Burlington, it doesn't matter whether you have it or not, but at maybe at your transfer.
As you know, wherever you're going, you're coming back. And if you're in, you know, JFK or you're in Chicago, it pays.
One of the joys of flying out of an airport like Burlington International is that, generally speaking, you don't have a long time to wait in security lines. And I know that you guys still tell people to show up 1 to 2 hours ahead of time, but you must have most people who are, you know, breezing in 45 minutes ahead of their scheduled flight because they know they can get through. And that's one of the wonderful things about having a small airport. Is that just because of your size, or is that because of something that you're also doing?
So we're going to address your risk takers. So even the director of aviation, drive my family crazy. I always get there 2 hours in advance because I don't want to miss my flight. But I think it's a combination of efforts. You know, you have an absolutely amazing airlines and staffing. You have great TSA. It's a combination of everybody trying to get you through. And then you have the other side, you know, which we really try to get people to experience what's best in Vermont.
So you're still telling people they have to show up an hour and a half early, even though?
At least.
Oh, come on.
Oh, absolutely. We want you to have that experience.
Now, let's talk delays as well. The Bureau of Transportation Statistics say that Burlington's on-time record so far this year is 80%, and on-time means within 15 minutes of a scheduled departure. So about 16% of flights have been delayed, about 3% canceled. How does that actually compare with other airports?
Above average.
As in better than?
Better than, yes. And again, most of our delays that we take are generally either mechanical or other airports, you know, not being able to fly into the larger hubs because of weather-related issues or traffic.
So not much of it is under your control?
Very, very little.
When is it something that would be an airport's fault?
Mechanical. You know, like if there was something that we could assist the airlines in, you know, change of a tire or fuel or something like that. But generally, you know, our FBO works really well. All the partners are teed up and do really well together.
Can we talk a little bit about what kind of airport Burlington is? Because, you know, you think, I mentioned Chicago's O'Hare, where we were hearing all of those stories of long wait lines. O'Hare is a hub, so people are coming in and out, and that may very well not be their final destination. That's not the way Burlington works. Burlington is not a place where you are transferring from one place to another. You are either starting your vacation or your trip or ending that flight in Burlington, right?
Yes.
So does that mean there are different pressures on an airport that is just sort of an end destination and a starting point than there would be on a place that sees a lot of transfers?
Sure. You know, typically, you're either, if you're coming back from vacation or your business trip, you're exhausted. If you're going to it, you're anxious to get there. So that's an anxiety level from the flying customer that we have to deal with, you know, if there's any issues. So again, we try to complement it. And if you've been through the airport, we try to make it Vermont. And we try to relax people from the rocking chairs to the food at Skinny Pancake. You know, there's different amenities that try to, including the music, that relax people and take that tension out, because traveling typically can be stressful for some people. So we try to address that right up front.
Plus the extra oxygen you're pumping into
Absolutely.
The air. Why does it matter whether you try to make it Vermont-y or not?
Well, that's what we are. I mean, Vermont, we reinforce Vermont over and over again throughout the airport.
But do people care? I mean, are people saying, I can't wait to get to the airport so I can sit in those nice rocking chairs and, you know, forget about the rest of my trip to Vermont?
I think they really appreciate the effort, you know, that we put into their experience that they're having. Even at Hudson News, you know, we sell 50% Vermont products. The Skinny Pancake, everything is, you know, sourced locally. So from, you know, the maple syrup to anything else, the rockers, the art, the whole experience, I think people do appreciate it. There's something nice and calming about it. And to know before you go on a trip that people care about you, it goes a long way.
Let's go to Ralph, who's calling in from Barton. Hi, Ralph. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm finding it difficult on more than one occasion to find the airport. There are far too few airport signage. The signage is like those signs cost $50,000 a piece. Like it's a secret.
Ralph, it's like Brigadoon. You're only supposed to find it when the mist clears. But what about that, Gene Richards? What about the idea that, you know, for people who aren't residents of the Chittenden County area or frequent flyers, it can be a little confusing around the airport to try to find out where you're supposed to go and how to get there.
It can be. And some of the things that we're doing to address that is worked with South Burlington, which is our host city, to put up more signs on Williston Road. We've also will be lighting the entrance. We've talked to Green Mountain Power about helping us put in new lights to light up the entrance of the airport a little bit. So those are some of the things we're doing. As far as the highway, you know, again, that's working with the state, and we haven't gone out that far. We've only looked with South Burlington and Green Mountain Power so far to highlight those areas.
There used to be a plan to make a direct spur off the highway to the airport. Is that just completely scrapped?
Well, we did it when we had larger employments. We had about 760,000 or $1.4 million a year, and that was about 2008, and it was justified. It's about a $76 million purchase to build that out, and it would be hard to justify today.
We're talking with Gene Richards about how the airport works and how, you know, behind the scenes, what is happening when you go to the airport and you're just trying to get your flight or get off your plane. What's actually happening at the airport level that might be interesting to know about as you perhaps consider flying on this holiday weekend? If you have questions about how Burlington International works, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page with your travel experiences and questions. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking with the Director of Aviation at Burlington International Airport, Gene Richards. We've been looking at some of the pressure on airports in terms of making sure your trip runs smoothly and you get through the security lines quickly. But there are a lot of other pressures on airports that we don't necessarily see as we breeze in and out, we hope, on our trips. We're going to talk about attracting airlines, how schedules are determined, and why overnighting planes is something BTV strives to do. And anything else you want to know about the internal workings of the airport, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Julie, calling in from Burlington. Hi, Julie. Go right ahead.
Hi there. I am a frequent flyer. I originally flew out of Detroit, which compared to Burlington is like night and day. But I have to say, I really do love flying out of Burlington. But my question is this. The airport seems the busiest between like the 4:30 and 6 a.m. period, and I am often the victim of those dreaded early morning flights. And so I was just wondering, is it because we're so far east that we have so many early morning flights?
Julie, thanks for the call.
The reason we have the early morning flights is so that people can make their connections at the hubs. We try to spread it out, but there's not as many connections, and they're not as popular later in the day. So when we got the Atlanta route, you know, that's when they wanted to fly exactly, you know, in that time frame, which is stressful for everybody and the airport.
Why is it stressful for the airport?
Because everybody comes at once, and that's why we have to spread them out as, you know, the 15 minutes or whatever.
Because every airline wants
everybody
to have an early
wants
flight.
To leave at the same time. But that is, if you look at all airports, morning is a very stressful time for us.
But it's also something that you want. I mean, you want to have those early morning flights, don't you?
Yeah, very important, especially for the business flyer or vacationer. You know, you don't want to start your vacation midday if you don't have to.
And then you don't catch a connecting flight until later.
And it may be the next day. So
in order to get those 5 a.m. flights, though, you need to have planes that are already in Burlington to be the first flight out for that airline. So you are trying to entice airlines to overnight their planes at your airport?
Yeah, very important. It's called a RON. And to have it overnight, it means that they can leave first thing in the morning and that you don't have that lag. So we do encourage them to have a flight in and a flight back, you know, late at night and then early in the morning. And that's some people, you know, they don't like the early flights in Burlington. They also don't like the late flights coming in. Both challenging for some people, but it's what works for the system.
What does it take to get an airline to say, sure, we'll overnight our planes with you?
it takes a lot of work. I mean, and a lot of communications and convincing them that it's going to do well. And it's all about the numbers. And fortunately, for Burlington has done quite well at attracting new routes.
So it's just about the numbers of flyers. It's not about having like maintenance and repair at the airport or a great hotel for pilots and flight attendants to be able to stay at and an attractive place for them?
Not as much. It comes down to the maintenance is done elsewhere typically. You know, we have the ability to do it, but they have other places to do their maintenance. The hotels were well serviced in the Chittenden County. So, we've talked about that, but it's not high on the list.
Let's go to Lou calling in from Waitsfield. Hi, Lou. You're on.
Hi. Hi. Yes. I was going to say that one of the nicest things you could do would be to put a board up outside as you arrive at the airport that tells you the times or delays, whatever, of arrival and departure. Because otherwise, you can't even park for a minute and run in and look at the board inside. So an outside board, which some of the nicer airports do, is put an outdoor board that you can see. You could be put in your cell phone lot. However, your cell phone lot is pretty pathetic. And that could be made a little bit nicer so you could go and wait in the cell phone lot. But the one or two times I've gone there, it was really pretty pathetic.
Lou, thanks for your call, and your cell phone is a little bit dicey there. So just to repeat for people who may have had some trouble hearing, Lou would love to have a digital board outside of the airport so people who are picking up passengers can see, is that flight that my loved one is on delayed? Can I stop here and pick them up? Are they likely to be outside? Or to have one at your cell phone lot, which Lou characterizes as pretty pathetic, Gene Richards.
I don't know if it's pathetic. It's very Vermont. But I do agree we could probably do better. The digital screen outside is a great idea, and we'll look into that, Lou. I like that idea a lot. I will also mention to people that have handheld or telephones that you can download apps that have the same information that we have on our boards. So in case you aren't able to get to the board because of traffic or one other, the apps also work. And FlightAware is a great one.
As long as you're not doing it while you're driving.
Absolutely,
which is against
not.
Vermont law.
But if you do it in the cell phone lot, it's not a big problem.
That's right. So right now, passengers at Burlington International can fly to the following locations: Atlanta, Charlotte, Chicago, Detroit, Newark, New York JFK and LaGuardia, Orlando, Philadelphia, Toronto in the winter, and Washington, Reagan, and Dulles. How are destinations and, I guess, the originating flights into Burlington determined?
Well, the last three that we brought in, we tried to switch it up a little bit. By bringing in Atlanta and Charlotte and Orlando, we grabbed the East Coast. So if there's a weather pattern coming in, we want to make sure that you have choices. And also, many people are migrating south, so we wanted to make sure that those airports could get you where you're going in the best possible way.
So it's just based on what you think the demographics of our population are?
It is, but it's also patterns that people, where they're going. And we analyze the data to see where people are going. And then we add the routes to where we think they're going to be going.
Where do you hear most from people that they would like to see a flight to?
Well, I think Fort Lauderdale is a big one. Denver is another one.
A direct to Denver?
Direct to Denver. And we also, as far as airlines, we hear Southwest over and over again. But what we try to do is balance it all out and bring in the routes, that we think that would be most helpful to people. We have talked about the Fort Lauderdale with two different airlines, and there's a good chance within the next 18 months that would happen. And the same with possibly the Denver. The Denver is a long stretch, but there's a good possibility.
And what about the idea of getting another airline in like Southwest?
Southwest is, we met with them about a month ago, and we actually had a pretty good strategy with them that I thought, they took note to. But we have to make sure that when you bring in that airline, you don't jeopardize the other partners. Burlington has a very good mix right now, and it's a very strong airport when it comes to service. So we want to make sure that we don't weaken that in any way.
Why would having another airline weaken that?
If it took service, like for Baltimore, for instance, with Southwest, it may hurt, United, and it may hurt American. So we want to
fly into the two DC airports.
Yeah. You want to be just careful that you don't put them out while you're bringing one in.
And who are the airports that you serve that we have right now? We have Delta.
You have Delta, American, Porter, JetBlue, and Delta, yeah.
And U.S. Air?
U.S. Air. American.
U.S. Air, American. So why not fly direct to Boston? That seems like one that would work well for an airport like this.
Yeah, it's a question. We met with, I think, 13 different airlines a month ago, and nobody has any interest. We have one airline in particular that we're courting that there's a possibility. But it comes down to the finances. JetBlue has a fair amount of good synergy there now. So we did talk to them about it, but they do want to keep their JFK hub healthy.
Oh, so for them, it's more they want you to fly into JFK. They don't want you to fly into Boston.
Exactly.
So for the finances, it just doesn't work for the airlines? It's not profitable enough?
Yeah, it comes down to the percentages. I mean, when we lost our Orlando flight several years ago, it was down to 7% more profitable someplace else. So fortunately, you know, we have Allegiant now going to Orlando.
So Burlington only has 9 gates, right? So are you constrained by the size unless you want to expand?
Not at all. You can actually manage those time frames, and I think that would work quite well. I mean, all those gates are ours except for one.
Why? Who's the other one belong to?
United.
So when you say they're yours except for one, so United actually owns one gate?
Yes, they do.
How does that work?
It's something that they brought in the jet bridge, and when they brought it in, the deal that we made with them, it would be assigned to them, and they would manage it and take care of it. The rest of them are managed by the airport.
Huh. That's an interesting arrangement.
Yeah.
Do other airlines wish they had that arrangement?
I don't think so. There's a lot of cost affiliated with it.
Let's go to Pat, who's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Pat. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you? I have a question for Gene. Gene, what do you see as the future for the airport? And what about the relationship with South Burlington?
Good question, Pat. You know, South Burlington was one of my early initiatives from the mayor, was to work on that relationship. And
how would you have characterized that relationship?
Stressful. And again, it's a small group of people, but it always is. And the majority, there's a population of 18,000 people in South Burlington, and we probably have a couple hundred that are not happy. And, you know, I think when you move next to an airport and you expect it not to be noisy, you know, that's a little unrealistic. But we have a responsibility to be a good neighbor. So I've spent my time working with the neighbors. We did the housing removal program, and we removed close to 100 houses last year that had been sitting for around 3 years held up in court. So,
and this was with the FAA, right?
Yeah, the FAA funded. So what we're trying to do is just make good gestures as a neighbor, work with them, talk with them. So I think the answer to Pat's question is that every day we're trying to do the right thing. Don't always know what that is. We know the direction we're headed in, and we'd like to listen to them and see what we can do to be a better neighbor.
What about the finances of the airport? Enplanements, people getting on the plane in Burlington, have been declining since the airport's high in 2008. Even though in the rest of the country and globally, airline travel has rebounded. And in fact, the International Air Transport Association said that U.S. air travel rose nearly 5% in 2015. When you look at BTV's stats, enplanements have been on a fairly steady but slow steady decline since 2008. Why don't you think you have rebounded the same way airline travel globally has?
If you would look at exactly the Canadian exchange, it tracks almost identical with that. We, in 2007-08, we had a lot of Canadian traffic, about 40%. So you will see the drop-off almost with the Canadian exchange. So I think much of what our growth was about the Canadian traffic. And I actually think if you look at with the new flights that we've put in, that's what's kept us from going down even worse. So I think when you see the Canadian exchange improve, you'll also see that improve.
Are you finding competition from places like Plattsburgh difficult with Canadian travelers?
I don't. I think they have the same stresses as we do, and they've done an amazing job over there redeveloping the old Air Force base. If anything, they complement airline service. We're very grateful that they're doing what they're doing, and we try to work with them as a partner.
We got a note from Brian in Jericho who says, yesterday my wife received a gate pass which enabled her to accompany her 91-year-old father to the waiting area and to the gate. And Brian wants to know, how easily are gate passes available? Could you do it for something as, quote, trivial as a meal at Skinny Pancake, just to spend time with a good friend who has 2 or 3 hours to kill? And on the same topic, BHA says, it would be really nice if you could get to the Skinny Pancake without having to be a ticketed traveler. I drop my daughter off, and there she sits for over an hour when we could be eating together.
Well, the answer is no, you can't do that to have dinner with somebody. But when it's an elder person or relative that needs assistance, absolutely. We'll try to accommodate people. We're actually in the works right now of bringing something fresh and new pre-TSA.
So we will be food-wise.
Food-wise. So we,
because there used to be a restaurant.
Absolutely. One flight up. And we're looking to start something very soon. So within the next 6 months, we expect to have something.
Gene Richards, what are the biggest challenges to your job, to running an airport?
Mine are financial. I've cut about $4 million out of the budget since I've been there, but we still balance our budgets every year. And then secondly is trying to keep our neighbors happy. That's something I think about every night, and it means a lot to me, and it's one of the things that it's hard to do.
What about the joys? I mean, what gets you excited to actually go to work at the airport every day?
I don't even sleep. I have to tell you, I cannot wait to get up and go there. It's
I don't know if I buy that.
That's the truth. If anybody that will tell you, I sleep about 3 hours a night, and I can't wait to get there in the morning, and I don't want to come home. And I have an amazing family, but I still can't wait to be there.
Why?
It's just an amazing, friendly place, and there's so much opportunity, and it's like my second home.
Do you fly a lot?
I do.
Where do you go?
I go to Florida a lot. I was just in Denver. I go wherever I can. I love everything about it.
And does everybody know your face at the airport so they know to, like, you know, get him through quick? There's the director.
No, I get treated just like everybody else. That's why I get there 2 hours early.
That's Director of Aviation Gene Richards. He's Burlington International Airport's top executive. Thanks for telling us a little bit about what it's like behind the scenes at the airport.
Thank you.
Coming up, a multi-year survey of residents in Chittenden and Grand Isle counties reveals the top community health needs and why a lot of health issues really aren't about just health care at all. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. UVM Medical Center and a big group of stakeholders have just released a comprehensive survey of community health needs. It's required by the Affordable Care Act, but UVM's actually been doing these kinds of surveys since the 1980s. Residents in Chittenden and Grand Isle counties assessed what they saw as the biggest health challenges in their communities, even ones that don't necessarily seem like they have that much to do with medical care. Penrose Jackson is UVM's Medical Center's Director of Community Health Improvement, and we asked her to describe the findings.
We did it in alphabetical order because we're very egalitarian, but the highest needs that we discovered were access to healthy food, affordable housing, chronic conditions, early childhood and family supports, economic opportunities, healthy aging, mental health, oral health and health care, sexually transmitted infections and teen births and substance abuse.
Well, let's talk about the substance abuse one first. In terms of both what you're actually seeing as a healthcare issue and need and what people are saying about it, where does substance abuse fall?
It falls as one of the highest when we prioritize. And we've been very careful about not prioritizing because each need is connected with every other need. But when we looked at the data, when we look at everything from crime statistics to our own prevalence and use of opioids that is leading to addiction and then people seeking treatment, it's high all over the place. So that's consistent.
You don't prioritize in the sense that you have that alphabetical
yeah.
order, but you do ask people to
yes.
rank their challenges, and you have some interesting charts in the report, which we have a link to at vpr.net for people who want to see it. Drug and alcohol use and substance abuse is ranked as a pretty high challenge to mm-hmm. overcome.
That's interesting because a while ago we compiled what we learned from our community going back into the early 1990s, and interestingly, substance abuse has been on every single survey and cited as a critical need in the community. So I think our community is pretty consistent in saying that, and it's pretty obvious that it is complex, or we would have figured out how to tackle it. And it isn't our problem. It's a state problem and a national problem.
It's fairly easy to see how substance abuse and health issues go together. one of the other challenges that you mentioned and something that people in the community say is a huge challenge, and that's affordable housing.
Yes.
So draw the connection between affordable housing and health and healthcare.
Well, 3 years ago when we did our needs assessment, the community said affordable housing. And we said, well, that's very interesting, but we're a hospital, and we have great colleagues in the community that we know will address this. And meanwhile, we'd been talking about people that have been staying with us for too long. They didn't need hospitalization, but we didn't have a place to discharge them safely back into the community. Very often these individuals, not always, but very often they were homeless individuals that needed more aftercare than you can get living as a homeless person. They needed a refrigerator to refrigerate medicines. They needed dressing changes, and they needed help from a visiting nurse or the like. And so we'd been despairing for many, many years over our inability to find a safe place for them to go. And so that's when the Champlain Housing Trust came to us with Harbor Place, and we helped guarantee some kind of bridge funding, which we actually never had to spend, and also bought motel rooms from them. We looked at our utilization. We bought a number of nights per month, and we've looked at those individuals that were housed there. We looked at their cost of care prior to their time at Harbor Place and subsequent to their time at Harbor Place, and it's a dramatic decrease of about 80%.
And Harbor Place, for people who aren't as familiar with it, used to be a hotel. It was purchased by the nonprofit, so now it's a place for families and individuals who are homeless and need emergency housing, but it's also used by people like the UVM Medical
Yes.
Center as a place where you can discharge people who don't otherwise have a place to go. You cite in the report that 60% of a person's health status is related to socioeconomic factors and physical environment, and only 20% is based on the clinical care that they get. And for those curious, the other 20% is based on genetics. Given that, how does that help you direct resources and care?
That's a lot of what we're learning right now. There's a move nationally toward population health. We're going to be paid increasingly for keeping people healthy. And the medical profession, hospitals and healthcare centers have recognized that we're only 20% of the equation, and we need to have very strong community partnerships in order to increase the health of the entire population, as I said. So we're trying to engage the community as best we can, because we recognize we can't leave our hill and do everything, but we can certainly partner more effectively and are seeking to do that.
Can you give me some examples of how you're doing that already? Because, I mean, you picture the hospital, and it's a hospital where you go for a medical procedure. I don't picture it as a social services area where I'm getting my needs met for affordable housing or pedestrian infrastructure.
Well, I'll pick on an easy one, and that's access to healthy food. And we've had a pilot underway now, I think this will be the third summer, where we, with our own practices, who identify low-income patients who are having difficulty accessing fresh foods, and actually purchase a share in a community-supported agriculture. Their weekly deliveries, and at those deliveries, we just don't hand them food. We help them understand more about healthy eating, and if it's something that's unfamiliar to them, like celeriac would be unfamiliar to me, we help them understand how to prepare it and why it's good for them. So those kinds of things are small, but they're effective, and every person who we can help, hopefully they'll talk to another person and on the ripples in the pond.
Your geographic area of focus in the community health assessments is Grand Isle and Chittenden counties. Do you have a sense of how those two counties compare to the rest of our state?
It's been pretty consistent over time. The poorer counties are faring less well. And that's part of the social determinants of health, that lower education, lower socioeconomic status, often you'll see poorer health outcomes. So while we have challenges in Chittenden County, and we have some trends that are going in the wrong direction, like sexually transmitted infections, we don't have the huge climb that some of our colleagues, predominantly in the Northeast Kingdom, are seeing. So we're pleased to be here. We're pleased to have a healthy population, but we can be even healthier.
Penrose Jackson is Director of Community Health Improvement at UVM Medical Center, and we've been talking about a just-released report, a community needs health assessment for Chittenden and Grand Isle counties. It's required under the Affordable Care Act, and we have a link to it at vpr.net. Penrose, thanks very much for speaking with us.
It's fun to talk about.
time again now for Summer School, our seasonal series devoted to learning new skills. This week, we get a lesson in how to make paint from scratch. No food coloring here. We're going back to the Stone Age. All right, if not back to the Stone Age exactly, we are going to go primitive and learn how you can use stones to create a unique pigment. Our instructor is Montpelier-based wildcrafting artist Nick Netto.
Got a collection of rocks from my recent travels. I'm going to make a pigment with the bluish-green rocks. I'm going to gather them up and put them into my granite mortar and pestle. And I'm going to put one or two in, and then I'm going to start smashing them. First thing I do is I smash that rock into a bunch of little smaller rocks, and then I'm going to start grinding it. So I'm going to do that as long as it takes to get a nice powder. Right now we're looking at kind of a light greenish blue. That's a really nice kind of rustic pigment as it is, and we could use it as a pretty fun paint. I'm going to get a jar. Any old jar works. It's nice if it has a lid. And now I'm going to carefully pour my pigments into that jar. I don't want to spill any of it because it's pretty precious stuff. The next step is to add a little bit of water to it to cover the pigment. I don't want to put too much water in, just a little bit. And now the next step is to put the lid back on, and I'm going to shake this up really vigorously. As I've stopped shaking this, immediately the larger of those pigment particles, the heavier ones, those are settling down to the bottom of the jar first. All the fluid that's still kind of floating around with pigment, I'm going to pour that into a different jar and save it. And then from there, you've got a nice pigment, and you can add another ingredient, which is your binder. The job of the binder is to keep the pigments suspended in the solution. So the binders can be egg, they can be glue, they can be honey. If you want to make oil paint, your binder would be some kind of oil. It can really be as simple as spitting in it. Saliva happens to be a wonderful binder. It's kind of perfect, actually. For this particular batch of paint, I'm going to use egg. It'll basically be an egg tempera paint. And you can use the white of the egg, but it gets kind of goobery. So I really enjoy using the yolk. I've got a bowl. I'm going to crack it on. Okay, and I've opened the egg, and I'm going to just kind of carefully pour the egg back and forth from one half to the other and let the egg white kind of drip away. Now I'm going to pour the egg yolk contents out into the jar of pigment. Now the trick is just to mix them all together, and then I'll work with it and see if I like it. And if it's too thin, I'll add some more pigment. And if it's too thick, then maybe I'll put in another egg. It's ready to work with. So get yourself a piece of paper or some other surface to paint on and give it a go.
That was artist Nick Netto with some tips on how to make paint from rocks. You will find photos and a link to Nick's artwork at vpr.net. And stay tuned all season for more Summer School. We'll be learning how to wash a dog, how to fix a cuckoo clock, and how to make the donuts, among other really useful skills. Our theme music is by Torpedo Rodeo. That's it for today. Tomorrow, Benedict Arnold was once a hero of the Revolutionary War, but his name became a byword for treason. He's the villain of our country's founding mythology. Tomorrow on the show, we'll piece together the real Benedict Arnold and the facts behind his betrayal with best-selling historian Nathaniel Philbrick. Send your comments or questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us live tomorrow at noon. Our producers are Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. We have production assistance from Jake Burstein. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.